as we moved forward with that comprehensive approach, technology continued to evolve, but so did the landscape of investors and stakeholders and shareholders and tenants. And people understood more over the course of the next decade how important this was. Not only how important it is, you know, for climate change, but more importantly, from a business perspective, how important it is for differentiating our portfolio, for creating a value proposition, for making our spaces healthier, more sustainable, higher performing, modernized spaces, and the value that that brings to our bottom line and to the bottom line of our tenants.
Hello, and welcome to this special episode of the REIT Report, part of our Building to Zero ongoing series on the journey of the real estate industry to reduce emissions from the built environment. I'm Jessica Long, NAREIT's SVP for Environmental Sustainability and Stewardship. And joining me today is Dana Schneider, Director of Energy and Sustainability and ESG at Empire State Realty Trust. Dana has spent her career focused on implementing energy efficiency and sustainability in real estate. And since joining ESRT, she has been a champion for the real estate industry in many discussions about smart policies and programs that support efforts to reduce energy from the built environment and decarbonize our cities. Welcome, Dana.
Hi, Jess. Thanks for having me.
So I just thought we'd get started. You know, ESRT has been at the forefront of the industry discussing energy efficiency for a long time. You've been part of a lot of high-level discussions about the role of building owners in wider efforts to decarbonize cities and how good policies and programs can really support building owners to create value in their building portfolios. So can you share a little bit about the role of decarbonization in your portfolio and some of the work that you guys are doing?
Sure. ESRT is different in that we began our journey on decarbonization over 15 years ago, 16 years ago now, focused on making the business case for deep energy retrofits. And so that work started at the end of 2007. So I have to do my math a little bit better because that's actually 17 years ago. And Tony and I have been working together for that long. So before coming to Empire State Realty Trust full-time, I was a managing director at JLL, where I led energy and sustainability projects in the Americas. And so Empire State Realty Trust had been one of my clients. I've worked with a lot of like the Fortune 500 companies on what their programs should be. And I've really had the privilege to kind of watch the evolution of the industry from explaining to people what sustainability was and focusing just on the energy optimization piece, because that's where the payback was always most clear and least debatable, right? And it still continues to be where we can prove it best. And so we started our work in 2007, focused on making that business case and also explaining the process and what the economics of doing so would be. So we created the process, we explained it and published it all to the community without any limitations. We shared our energy modeling, we shared our financial modeling, we showed what every step of the process would look like. And we demonstrated then that we could have a guaranteed savings of 38% with a guaranteed payback of 3 years, which is outrageous. Frankly, it's better than even we thought it would be. But more important than just the result, which is outstanding, was the idea that we could share the process and show what worked, what didn't work, you know, how to do the right steps in the right order, how to work the outside of a building in, and how to make sure you're never ignoring tenant spaces, that you're always including things like the envelope, where a typical energy audit excludes all those things, right? And you're only looking at lighting and chillers. There's way more to the story than that. As we moved forward with that comprehensive approach, technology continued to evolve, but so did the landscape of investors and stakeholders and shareholders and tenants. And people understood more over the course of the next decade how important this was. Not only how important it is, you know, for climate change, but more importantly, from a business perspective, how important it is for differentiating our portfolio, for creating a value proposition, for making our spaces healthier, more sustainable, higher performing, modernized spaces, and the value that that brings to our bottom line and to the bottom line of our tenants. And so we focused more on how can we even do more. Legislation is also changing at the same time. So we talk about physical and transitional climate risk, with Local Law 94 being approved in 2019 in New York City. Tony and I discussed coming here full time, focusing on making the business case then for our buildings to be net zero. What's the technical economic case for the buildings to get to an 80% reduction in emissions by 2030 for the Empire State Building, 2035 for the whole portfolio, ahead of the Paris Accord and also in line with or ahead of Local Law 97 to avoid fines. And so we started working on that, which is where we are now. We've now completed the analysis in every building in our portfolio, which is an intense analysis, I would say. You know, planning for net zero isn't just saying we're going to be net zero by a certain date. Right. Planning for it means you actually have the plans in place. So we've done that now. And we've made all those plans and case studies public, again, so that each typology in our portfolio is there now for Jess can look and say, well, this building that I have has a boiler and a central plant for HVAC. So what should I do? We have a building like that. You can pick exactly what we did off the tree and see what to do there, right? So that buildings who don't have the resources to develop the how, we've published the how with a full list of all the hundreds of measures we considered, which ones work, which ones didn't work. Everything works technically. Some things don't have the payback we need yet, but the payback we need as a publicly traded company is much more rigorous than the payback you would need if you were a municipality, university, a school, a hospital, on NYPA power, for example, DCAS. You could actually, you know, any kind of public funded place would be on a way longer payback scale. In that case, you could implement almost everything we came up with.
That's so exciting that you're publishing that information. I do remember when I started in this space, seeing the case study on the Empire State Building and thinking, okay, this is happening. This is a real opportunity, not only for a career path, but also this is happening. And if a building of that size and that scale could do it, many of the buildings that I was working on at the time were candidates as well. And I think it's really important, as you said, that the case for energy efficiency in many cases was a no-brainer. You had these short-term paybacks and they were proven savings. I think as we move along the journey in decarbonization, you get to retrofits and replacements that might not be as straightforward of a business case. And so the more information that is out there about what folks are doing, what savings and opportunities and costs are associated with it, is going to help move the market as far as understanding how we can do this at scale. Public companies, I think public REITs are a huge part of the conversation because of that transparency that they offer and the leadership of companies like ESRT voluntarily putting out this information. I really applaud you guys for doing that and also appreciative and hope a lot of the listeners really understand that this is a resource that's available to them now.
Yeah, absolutely. When you publish this, Jessica, we can add links to case studies and other resources for the listeners so that you can use them, write papers on them, replicate it. We always kind of knew that it would differentiate us to be ahead of the curve and be able to tell the tenants they'll meet their own health safety goals, their own disclosure goals. All that will happen just from being in our buildings. And that's a huge advantage, but there's no reason not to share that with everyone, right? The whole built environment has to do this. The more we can prove through shared case studies that there's more value delivered in doing this than by not doing this, the better off we are, right? And I think that's one of the most important things that we continue to prove. This works. There's no debate this works. The only debate is it a 5-year payback or an even better payback, right? And that's where the debate starts coming in. Some of the work that we've been doing now is not just to continue to make that strong technical investment case, but also together to advise policy to make sure it continues to help us to do this work effectively and to deliver these results in the market. So we'll continue that work.
Yeah. So speaking of policy, we know that New York City was out early with Local Law 97 and many other local laws before that. How have the conversations and the evolution of the partnership and the discussions between building owners and the city, how have those evolved over time? How have building owners participated in those conversations? And now we're seeing cities and jurisdictions all over the country implementing building performance regulations, and not all of those locations really have the real estate community present in the discussions the way that in New York. I was here in DC when those discussions started here, and we were lucky that we had boots on the ground to participate. And so what can you share about how those discussions go, the partnership between building owners and the city as those regulations and really overall objectives to decarbonize the built environment progress?
I'll focus on the positive side because you'll always hear people complaining about any legislation. I think that Local Law 97 in New York City and the process to get here was all directionally correct. I think that they did their best, especially because it started with Mayor Bloomberg. And I think that putting it into context, and we were joking about how many green code laws there are in New York, but the green code work the green codes is what we originally called them. And that was under Mayor Bloomberg. And this work really starts in 2005, 2007, creating the foundation on which all these laws get built, the development of Plan YC, the development of our benchmarking laws, right? Local Law 84, Local Law 86, the first ones that came, Local Law 87, things around mandatory retrocommissioning, mandatory submetering, mandatory lighting performance, and the greater Plan YC for sustainability, the foundation of the Mayor's Office of Sustainability, moves like that that over time culminated in the 2019 passage of Local Law 97, which is the most aggressive law for the built environment and climate change in the world. And it basically caps emissions limits on buildings for the amount of fossil fuels that buildings use, right? As their nature, right? You have to heat buildings, you have to cool buildings, you have to give people power. Right now, the grid in New York City is not a renewably sourced grid, right? And so in combination, and this is really important because we also knew this from the very beginning working on our technical working groups, and Mayor Bloomberg really set that up well, to have technical working groups, experts from the practitioner level to advise at least what the technical approach of these rules should be. Not all of that has been integrated, and you'll hear a lot of whining about that, but they did ask us, and we were at the table. You know, and at the end of the day, the law and the rules as they stand now aren't perfect, but they're also not final, right? This is going to evolve a little bit. I don't think that the limits will change, and I don't think that the timing will change, and it has not done. The rules that came out as of December 2023 are pretty clear, and it gives everyone enough time to begin that planning process, right? We all knew this was coming in 2019. So between when the law is passed and the first disclosure years, more than 5 years to start preparing. And the opinion of the practitioners was taken into account to an extent. I think there was a tremendous amount of work done by the advisory board, and we were really honored to be the only owner on that board. I do think that was a flaw, right? Because on the whole board for Local Law 97, which impacts building owners the most, we were the only building owner on that board. I'm grateful we were there. I do think that voice was really important, especially a voice of an owner like ESRT, where we want this to work, right? We weren't there to complain. We weren't there to say this will never work. We were there as the example of here is the best way to do it. How do we make this law work in a way that encourages all the owners to do it and enables them to be able to do it? What's the role of the owner? What's the role of the grid? What's the role of the landlord? What's the role of the tenant? And those are some of the details I think we're still working to iron out, frankly, because the Department of Buildings, which administers Local Law 97, doesn't have jurisdiction over tenants, except when they're getting designed and built out. And so a lot of the challenge, I think, remaining lies in how do we make sure that's a partnership, right? Because we can't do it without our tenant and their cooperation. We've done a lot of work to make that partnership, but we've done it in the business case of trying to differentiate ourselves by partnering with our tenants on these high-performing spaces. It's also really important to note that the business case for these investments to work are based on the grid in New York State and New York City doing what that grid's meant to do. And that is not in any case an abstraction. The CLCPA is the law for New York State requiring the decarbonization of the grid, the same way that Local Law 97 requires the decarbonization of New York City. And they have to work in partnership with each other. So the split comes to about 50-50. The renewable sourcing of the grid in New York accounts for about half the reduction, and buildings reducing their usage by 50% and then electrifying what's left is actually how we get there. And I don't think people talk about that enough, because I still hear way too much noise thinking that one or the other will do it alone. And it really—
yeah, and the timing, right? It's these things have to meet up at the right time. If you electrify your building before the grid is green, then are you adding more? You're adding more carbon. And so—
I don't feel like we're in danger of that happening. I think a lot of noise around it is really pretty funny. You know, I hear people saying, oh, well, we're going to have winter peaking, but we won't if we do the reduction in the loads the right way. So we plan for how those loads reduce, because we've modeled every one of our buildings this way. In no case does our winter peak exceed our summer peak, you know, electrification. But it does have to be done in a way, obviously, that's reducing and managing those loads.
That makes a lot of sense. And we took a cue from New York in the DC law and made sure that technical working group was included in the law, that it was required, and that building owners had to be represented, because I think it's so important to have the voice of the building owner in these discussions. A lot of people don't understand how commercial real estate works. And you bring up things like about the tenant-landlord relationship, you're talking another language. And so I think it's really important that as the building owner community, we're out there communicating what makes sense and continuing to really be clear on, you know, we really want this too, and we need to find ways that that make sense and make business sense.
Agree. Yeah, and the way that we share with each other, communicating with each other, being open about what's working and what's not working, I think the collaboration of the sustainability experts absolutely sets the bar and the example for how everybody should be working together, especially for something as important as this, where the lessons learned do scale. And I think we do a great job of that. So thanks for hosting podcasts like these that we can share.
Yeah, more. Thanks. And plug for NAREIT. NAREIT members are an opportunity to join our Sustainability Council and be part of discussions about this on a regular basis. And there is no lack of topics for us to talk about and be a part of. So wrapping things up, we were talking about kind of the partnership with public entities and the cities, but really we are businesses, we are for-profit businesses, as most REITs are. So the importance of really communicating that value. A lot of times we talk about the cost to decarbonize, but we don't do and spend enough time talking about the value. So can you talk a little bit about how you guys are thinking about the long-term value of decarbonization and how you're communicating that to your stakeholders?
We communicate the value of decarbonization in many ways, but the most clear-cut case for it is the way that we have created our model itself, right? Which is that we it also counts for embodied carbon, which is really important, right? In all buildings, we're on a maintenance cycle. These things don't last forever without maintenance, same as like your house or your car, right? And when equipment or systems or technologies run their course, we work to replace them the right way at that time. We work to retrocommission and retrofit what's existing as much as we can. And then when we've reached that, 25-year-old chiller point, or when the boilers are 30 years old and they're ready to be replaced, then we replace them with the heat pump system. When our BMS controllers are starting to fail around 10 years old, now we're going to fully open protocol, guideline 36 rollouts. The way that we make the case is that that incremental cost of investing in something that gets us to net zero, that's higher performance, that's more comfortable, that's more modern, that's healthier in every way better, the incremental cost of that is typically nominal. It's a cost you'd already incur for proper maintenance and replacement. Doing that the right way really delivers for us a very strong return on investment. The IRR is outrageous. For the kind of work we do, we're typically targeting a 5-year or less payback, sometimes on a huge building, it's an 8-year or less payback, but in any case, these returns are outstanding, both in a small space, a big space, a whole building. We run it all the ways.
You've mentioned the integration with capital planning a couple times, and I think it's so important that a lot of times these sustainability programs are kind of sitting off on this side, and the more that you are embedded within the broader business plan, the more success you'll see.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the most critical things that Tony Malkin, our CEO, has done, is to integrate sustainability as just part of what we do. And truly it is, right? Empire State Realty Trust, one of our most important goals is meeting our sustainability objectives. In turn, we're extremely responsible with what those sustainability objectives are, and they are all geared towards making our buildings higher performance buildings, right? So when sustainability is seen in the comprehensive way we see it, it's about the engineering, it's about the modernization, it's about the systems, communication, automation. That makes it a critical part of the building performance, the value we bring to our shareholders, to our tenants, making our buildings future-proof and modern and high performance, and measuring both the performance value of that and also the financial performance of that, and the expiration of tying this to investment, tying this to access to capital, tying it to return on investment makes it a critical part of what we do and the performance of our assets, and not just a bolt on.
Yeah, completely agree. It's so nice talking to you. Is there anything else you'd like to share about what you guys are working on, what's coming up in the world of sustainability this year?
I'm sure there's lots more and we can do another podcast. I think the focus on decarbonization is the most important thing for today. And getting the word out that this works, the technologies already exist. The payback has been proven over and over. Just get out and start the work. Let's go.
Thank you so much for joining us today. I want to thank all of our listeners for joining us on this episode of the REIT Report special series, Building to Zero. If you enjoyed this discussion and are interested in learning more about REIT sustainability, check out nareit.com/sustainability. And we look forward to bringing you insights that help develop and deliver strategic initiatives that create value and drive long-term sustainability of your business. If you'd like to hear more about what's happening in the REIT industry, you can subscribe to the REIT Report or leave a review wherever you access your podcasts.